the weekly meeting of the TechNet, which meets every Sunday, usually for 4 hours, but not a guarantee. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also be hearing from Dr. Roy, AC2GS, and Paul, WS2N. And those two guys maintain the science and physics report as well as the space report. By way of what Elon Musk did last week, a very significant launch of a very heavy piece of hardware that went very far into space. We're going to be hearing a lot about what he's done and what he's about to be doing. And by way of the emails that Dr. Roy is now starting to get, we're going to be hearing specific things that people request on the science and physics report. Roy will be again giving you the exact address for you to go to. And when it comes to what subjects you'd like to discuss on science and physics report, that's a matter of what you guys request, what you're interested in. Roy's very adaptable. He's got a lot of smarts in a lot of particular areas. Let me drop the usual menu for this net, which can be changed if you guys have got strong enough feelings, is that for the first hour or so, depending on the amount of sign-ins and enthusiasm, we take people who check in who do have a question or comment for the net. So a person checks in, gives us their call letters and name, and says, yes, they do have a question or a comment. And we handle those in order. That's followed by the space and then the science and physics report by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. And he'll discuss anything you're interested in, so you can vote on what you want. He might even give you a list of things to choose from, so to speak. And then that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report. Paul will be giving a space report number 287 tonight. This will be TechNet number 1,687. The TechNet began September of 1982, 34 and a half years ago. And yes, I'm amazed that it's lasted that long. I expected to, me and the founding people at that time expected to answer the questions in a couple of weeks, dry up and go away. There's always a thirst for radio knowledge because the books in the schools only do a partial job of teaching that art and science. Let me drop. So we've always got new amateurs joining the hobby. We've always got new modes of amateur radio being invented. There's about 26 different kinds of ham radio right now. And 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, the one you're listening to, is just one of the 26 kinds. Arguably, this is one of the most educational hobbies, and it can be an awful lot of fun, as well as being very useful. But if you want to know somebody who understands radio equipment, with rare exception, you've got to hire a ham radio operator, because the schools only do a mediocre job, in my opinion, of teaching that in useful engineering form. Let me drop. When I pass it back to you guys, try to remember to listen for the four beeps. If not, if you pick up the mic too soon, quite possibly you'll be timing out. We'll have trouble hearing you. Eric, KE2EJ, our technical maven, who maintains all of his equipment, is on the way to the site right now to repair a faulty internet connection. So therefore, tonight, people are not hearing IRLP, they're not hearing the Selden repeater, 147.375, they're hearing nothing but this particular repeater for the time being until Eric gets a chance to repair that. And maybe in the next 15 to 20 minutes, that will be up and running for the next 3.5 hours, so to speak. Let me drop. And I guess we also have a chat room. I presume, let me pass it over to Roy, who monitors the chat room. I presume, Roy, people in the chat room are letting us know that IRLP and the Selden machine, IRLP and the Selden machine is not working. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, who monitors the chat room, among other things. K2RIW, you got it, Roy.
AC2GS, yes, among other things. No, they're kind of quiet. They only two people checked in. By the way, if anyone's interested in visiting our little chat room, it's on the front page of the website, limarc.org. or I made an alias to get you there a little bit quicker. You can just type in chat.limarktech.net, and it'll take you to the front page of the chat room. But we only have two people there right now. Actually, one of them just left for a moment, so it's just me and another guy.
I think one of the other rep and sign-in techniques you made is chat.ac2gs.com. Is that one way to get to the mailbag? Roy, over to you.
I can make that alias work. Right now, I figured I would keep it all in the same domain as limarktech.net. So it's chat.limarktech.net. But I can make it work for AC2GS as well.
Yeah, for some people, that may be a little bit easier to remember. So, yeah, that's an easy one to remember, chat.ac2gs.com. And that any communication to you by way of mailbag or whatever could possibly go that way. Is that true, Roy?
I basically have the ac2gs.com domain to myself. So if you type in anything at the head of it, like AU or what's your name or Roy or TechNet or I got a question or anything at ac2gs.com, it'll all come to me eventually.
Okay. So after the chat, I had chat.ac2gs. Maybe it should be a chat at ac2gs.com. Is that the better way of addressing you, Roy? Go ahead.
Well, that serves two different purposes. If you want to contact me with email, again, anything at ac2gs.com will get me an email. But if you go over to a browser and you type in, once I fix it, chat.ac2gs.com, that's a browser address, and that will take you to a website.
I see. Okay. You must be down to three, four, or five individual domains at this time, or URLs, is that true, Roy?
I've lost count, but I think I have seven or eight. I have R.S. Laufer, I have Roy Laufer, I have Roy S. Laufer, I have Brooklyn Doc, I have a bunch of other ones, just for the heck of it. I collect them, I guess.
When it comes to the technical net that you run on the Brooklyn Repeater, the Kings County Radio Club, does that also have a particular email address by which they can address you for that technical net, that mailbag? Over to you, Roy.
Yes, I also maintain the domain kc2rc.com, which is the call sign of that repeater. But that goes to me as well.
Okay. Alrighty, so at this time we're going to take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. Need not check in to say you're listening. After 34 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed to us anymore. So you're going to give us your call letters, your name, because I'm very forgetful, but I like addressing people by name, followed by yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Try to remember to wait for the 4-beep. So if you're going to check in with a question or a comment, give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. We're listening. Wait for the beeps. One more call. Nobody with any questions or comments. Maybe the lack of the internet connection is really cutting down our audience tonight. One more call. Nobody with a question or a comment? Give me a call with his name right now.
This is NO2NO with a quick comment.
NO2NO. Start off with your name, sir, and then make your comment. It doesn't have to be quick. We got lots of time. You got it, sir.
I'm I forgot to say my name. Name here is Fred, Foxtrot Romeo Echo Delta. Call sign is November Oscar 2, November Oscar in Hicksville. And I'm going to let it drop, and then I'm going to ask a silly question or a silly comment. Okay, so here it is. There's a four-tone indicator thing, you know, at the end of every transmit, and it's cute. But for some reason, the tones in it activate my voice command on my GPS, and there it goes. There's something about the tones or the volume of the tones or something that goes right to voice command in my GPS, and I'm wondering if anyone else has experienced this. It's a Garmin GPS.
I'll see if anybody has a comment on that. I'll pass it over to the net first, and then I'm going to pass it over to Eric in that order. So, has anyone else experienced the four tones triggering their GPS or any other piece of equipment in their house or their car? Give me your call letters right now. Eric, KE2EJ, how did you select those four tones? And is it overly coincidental that it triggers a GPS receiver in Fred's car? KE2EJ, Mobile, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Sorry, Dick, I was just talking to the guy at the gate. What was the question?
NO2NO, Fred, just reported to us that the four tones that we have in between our transmissions are just the right tones that trigger his Garmin GPS receiver. So where did you get those four tones? And are you familiar that there's something magic about them that it triggers a Garmin GPS? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K3J. I collected the tones, and I collected tones which were not the same frequency as touch tones, so actually they're musically related. But as far as triggering the device goes, well, you know, what can I say? Every now and then the touch tone decoder and the repeater gets false from voices, but I don't have an answer for you.
Hey, you doing, Anthony?
Go right ahead, AMZ.
For whatever it's worth, my wife's voice triggers my Garmin GPS.
So are you saying, Mike, when you talk, when your wife talks, it triggers the GPS? Is it when she says certain things? Does it do it every time? Give us a couple of words on that, Mike.
My wife's voice is kind of a high-pitched, call it squealy voice, squeaky voice, if you want to call it that. Just plain talking. It doesn't matter what she says. But for whatever it's worth, my wife's voice also sets off my GPS. It goes into voice command.
Has anyone else ever ran into that problem where a particular voice or particular tones will trigger some other piece of equipment, like their GPS receiver? Has anyone else other than Mike and Fred run into this? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet. Mike, does your wife's voice do that every time, no matter what she says, or is it only when she says certain things?
Again, for what it's worth, my wife's first language is Russian, so when she's in the car with me, it's the Russian language. But it doesn't really matter. I just think it's just frequencies, harmonics, which sets it off. Go figure. Hey, you know what? Someday somebody should just call the Garmin people and ask them. And I bet you they're not going to have an answer. But my wife's voice does set it off.
Mike, are you fluent in Russian language?
Yes, I am, Dick.
out of curiosity, is that because of your country of origin or just something that you happen to study?
That comes because my parents came over here to the United States after World War II. The language being spoken at home at the time was Russian. And when I went to kindergarten, when you're like 5, 6 years of age, you could pick up a language in about 15 minutes. I wish I could do that now.
So I think you're saying when you first came here or when you first went to kindergarten, you hadn't yet learned to speak English. Is that what you're saying, Mike?
That's exactly what I'm saying. So going to school in the early 60s, not speaking English, I'll let you figure how that one went over. But yeah, I learned how to speak English very fast, and a lot of my Russian friends did too. Same thing too.
So when you went to school here at first, kindergarten or first grade, it took you a couple of months to be able to talk to the teacher and your friends?
I pretty much was able to speak pretty fluent, relatively speaking, pretty fluent English after a couple of months in kindergarten. But remember, when you're 5 or 6 years of age, kids pick up languages, they're like sponges when it comes to that. I wish adults were like that.
Were you a bit mistreated during the first couple of months before you were able to talk back in their language?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, and that was a political thing. Remember, that was the Cold War going on then. But hey, you know what? You learn and live. No big deal.
That was way back in, what, 1960 or so? 1970?
More like in the 60s, early 60s, before Kennedy died. Or actually, right about the time of Kennedy's assassination.
Yes, I lived through that period as an electronic engineer working for a company that built electronic countermeasures equipment. And I'm very familiar with the fact that there was a Cold War going on. We were all shaking in our boots. And we had just basically barely passed through that period of time when we were practicing duck and cover, nuclear bombing and all that kind of jazz was the fear of the day. Now, when you think about it, it was kind of crazy. The chances of that really being required was very slim as I see it. So, looks like at least one other thing can trigger a Garmin receiver, Fred. NO2NO for any other further comments. K2IW the TechNet.
N1YDY.
Go right ahead, Hank.
Again, it was before my time, but when I worked for Grumman, a lot of the guys that were there suggested that it was Carl Sagan that really put an end to the concept of a winnable nuclear war when he discussed the concept of a nuclear winter. And it wasn't until that time that the folks really took the end of the world seriously.
Yeah, the guys who worked with me in those days still meet once a week for a luncheon, and we now discuss the fact that it was kind of silly to worry about that. I mean, the population of Russia was quite a bit smaller than the United States. The chances of them attempting to take over the whole United States would be kind of silly. What are they going to do, surround us? I mean, all those thousands of miles away, an ocean separated. If they tried to take over the United States, it would be rather difficult. The chances of success would be rather slim. And even if you succeeded, what are you going to do with a takeover, if you know what I mean? So the chances of that being reality, as I see it, are awfully slim. And so the tremendous amount of resources that were spent on both sides building up nuclear hardware was kind of a waste, as I see it. But maybe I'm naive. Anyway, any further comments? Give me a call. That is K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. KD2NZ, one more comment. Brookhaven National Labs, and they had the graphite pile reactor as a result of that. That's where they invented multi-weight oil. So So something good came out of the Cold War. We got multi-weight oil, or multi-viscosity weight oil.
Do you consider multi-viscosity oil a good thing, a breakthrough? Over to you, Mike.
Well, it works really good in my car in the winter and summer, so something good came out of it. I'm being rather sarcastic now, obviously, but hey, you know, it's the way it goes.
YDY with a comment.
You got it, Hank.
Yeah, you know, obviously the multi-grade stuff wasn't so wonderful in the beginning because the viscosity index improvers that were used would tend to shear, but as chemical engineering got better, the stuff we have now is absolutely significantly better than anything we had before. Mercedes-Benz used to do a series of testing, and they would tell you that you should only use certain grades of oil from certain manufacturers. And after 1992 or 3, I can't remember what year it was, but sometime in the early 90s, they basically came out and said anything that meets the current SAE standard is acceptable in their engines.
Now, Toyota, among other cars, had a problem with their engines gelling, is the word they use for it. In other words, the variable viscosity material, which is called a coagulant. In other words, ordinarily oil becomes thinner as you heat it up. And by putting this extra chemical substance in there, which becomes thicker when you heat it up, you get a more constant velocity, a more constant viscosity. That's the good news. And if you're willing to change the oil every 3,000 or 5,000 miles, that works okay. If you leave the oil in there longer than that, the coagulant breaks down, turns into a sludge, and will gel up something like a Toyota engine, among others. I've got a philosophy that I change the oil in my car once every year, whether it needs it or not. And I insist on putting in 30-weight oil. Fixed viscosity, 30-weight oil, summer, winter, spring, and fall. My philosophy on that is the following. I don't want to spend all of that time changing the oil every month or so. That would be a pain to me. I do it once every year, whether it needs it or not, and I change the filter at the same time. Second of all, once you turn that engine on, within about 60 seconds, the engine is fairly warm, and the oil is up to normal running temperature. The oil is only cold for the first 60 seconds. So, in other words, you're putting all this fancy chemistry in there, which if you leave it in too long can gel your engine, and you're doing that to protect the engine, so to speak, for the first 60 seconds, maybe 120 seconds. It's a very brief period of time until the oil is hot in that engine. On top of that, people think that 30-weight oil in the wintertime is going to be so thick it's going to be hard to start the engine. There's very little oil on that cylinder. It all drips down the last time you turned off that engine. There's very little oil there when you first turn it on a cold day. If you measured the real cranking current, if you were using 30-weight oil or multi-viscosity oil when you're starting the engine on a cold day, I think the difference is very small. I will admit, if I was living in the Arctic, where the temperature goes to minus 40, that would be a little bit more severe. But from where I live, 30-weight oil, 365 days a year, all the days of the year, works to me like a charm. Whenever any garage does any work on my car, they look inside and say, how in the world do you keep your engine so clean? You must change your oil every month. I say, no, I change it once every year. And they look at me strangely. I know this is a controversial opinion. Every time I express this to anybody at a garage, they say, what planet are you living on? K2LAW listening. Give me a call if you want to make a comment on this crazy subject of mine.
One YDY, I'll comment, because I did a lot of research on this back in the 90s. And I saw
repeater, timeout.
Industry that was available in the 90s, that's not a bad concept. In addition to Toyota, you had engines like the Saab engine, the GM Saab engine, after GM took it over. Not the original 900 Saab engines, but the one that GM built for Saab. They called it sludge, but it was the same basic stuff. What would happen is that the viscosity index improvers would be too effective, and if you didn't change the oil, you would end up with stuff that blocked the galleys. It really depends on the design of the engine, and the chemistry of the oil has changed so much and I really think that you're not recognizing the amount of wear and tear that occurs in that initial startup. It takes a lot longer than 120 seconds for the oil to warm up. And I have actually looked at the starting current with different weights oil when I had a diesel in my boat, and the boat was in Miami. And in the winter, where the temperatures only got down into the low 60s and high 50s at the coldest, the amount of current that was shown on the starter motor during the start sequence was almost double with the same grade of oil as what it would be in the 80s. And one YDY.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now, Mike, you picked up without waiting for the beeps. And by some means, your voice did come through, even though you technically timed out the machine. So, you personally have measured a 2-to-1 difference in starting current, and what grades of oil were you using this, and what was the temperature? Give us a few more words on this experiment that you did. Over to you, Hank, and wait for the beeps.
Okay, it was in a Yanmar 4JH HTDE engine manufactured in 1989 for the engine. It was a 2-liter turbocharged diesel engine that produced 66 horsepower at full boost. So we're not talking high output here. It was in a boat that was in Miami, and the oil was always Shell Rotella 15W40. So this is a multi-grade oil, and the charging system in the boat had a ammeter that was capable of showing 1,200 amps max load, and the engine would normally draw about 500 amps, 400 to 500 amps, when the temperature was above 80 degrees, and it would draw as much as 1,100 amps or so when the temperature was in the high 50s, low 60s.
KC2, SSA.
KD2FIU, additional comment.
Now, this discussion and this experiment you did, Hank, is with a so-called hot and a cold day in Miami. You didn't tell us what oil you were using and how it changed when you changed the oil. Back to you, Hank.
Sorry, I thought I said it was Shell Rotella 15W40, and that's the only grade of oil that I use. And we're not talking different viscosities. I'm talking one multi-viscosity oil that had different draws based on the temperature of the engine.
And therefore, you don't know what would have happened if you had a constant viscosity oil in there, is what I think you're saying.
That's correct. I'm only commenting on a multi-grade oil that was recommended for that engine by the manufacturer.
And if that oil, if the multigrade in that oil was really keeping the viscosity constant as a function of temperature, shouldn't the current have been constant as a function of temperature?
I would agree. I'm just telling you what I observed. I'm not telling you that I understand exactly what happened.
Okay. The way you worded it three transmissions ago led me to believe that you had done an experiment with multigrade versus non-multigrade oil, and saw the difference in starting current. Now, I understand, you saw the difference in starting current for multigrade oil in a particular engine on a hot and cold day in Florida. Okay, we've got FFA and and George. FFA, give me a full call with us, Mr. FFA, and your name, K2LIW. I heard somebody checking with FFA. We'll go over to George, FIU. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. I got to agree with you. It's what we would call straight 30. Straight weight 30 was the way to run an engine, a performance engine, and knowing over the years that it was also a good cleaner. It wasn't a detergent oil. Straight weight 30 I used in automobiles that I had restored during the late 70s and the early 80s. 59 Austin Healey Frog Eye Sprite. 59 Austin Healey, BN6 Le Mans Roadster, 65 Austin Healey. I moved away from those kind of oils and was running my American cars with multi-grade. Let me let it drop and come back. KC2 SSA. Okay, Dick, I also ran it in a 71 Jaguar XKE42. Straight weight 30. These oils were considered to be best lubricants and were natural cleaners without detergents. I moved away from that over many years. Maybe about 15 years ago, picked up a Buick, which had a 5.7 liter LT1 high performance engine in it. Decided to run that with straight weight 30 also. My mechanic at the time told me it was the best decision I could make. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, thank you, George. A number of people who do professional racing are also using straight 30 all the time, summer, winter, spring, and fall. Each garage that finds out what I'm doing, they give me all kinds of warning. My engine's going to explode immediately, and the manufacturer's going to void the warranty, and they give me all kinds of warnings. Everyone believes that multi-viscosity, multi-grade oil is the most superior stuff to use in your engine. I strongly disagree, because that coagulant, it turns into sludge if you're not changing it up pretty fast. Let's see what Phillips has to say about all this. KC2, Sierra, Sierra Alpha, K2RIW. Go ahead, Phillips. I'm pretty sure that twice KC2 Sierra Sierra Alpha signed in. He's trying to pass it back to him. He's not there. Go ahead, Philip.
And 2APG has a question.
And 2APG, K2RIW, you got it, Dave.
Is it okay to ask a ham radio question at this point in time?
It sure is. This is the ham radio question time. And we weren't getting any check-ins. So we got into automobiles, among all things. You got it, Dave.
Okay. Very fine. Good evening to all. The simple question, I want to attach two pieces of coaxial cable together. Let's say they're RG58. I have two pieces. And I want to attach them together, but I don't have any PL259s, I don't have any barrel connectors, I don't have anything like that. All I have is a soldering iron, and I have a knife and a scissor and some electrical tape and things like that. And I'm a very crafty ham. So my question is, will I be able to splice together these two pieces of RG58 cable successfully, and will I be able to call for help on my radio after I do that, Dick? Go ahead.
Absolutely, with rare exception. If you're doing it on 1296, you'd have some trouble. But if you're doing it on 2 meters and below, with reasonable short leads on the way you connect the center conductor together and the way you connect the shield together and the rest of it is exposed, work like a charm. That little section where you've got open wiring of where you've soldered the two pieces together, if I had to pick a number, I'd say that section has got an impedance of 100 ohms. And now, if by way of a Smith chart or the equations or whatever you study, what happens if you put a 1-inch length of 100-ohm coax in between two pieces of 50-ohm coax? If you study what you're doing when you do that, the 1-inch length or 1.5-inch length, that's a very open wiring, has a high impedance because it's the center conductor and the shield, and the shield is not completely enclosing the center conductor with Teflon unless you do some very fancy mechanical work. But because you're, let's say you're doing the work at 6 meters, 6 meters where the wavelength is 20 feet or so, the wavelength is 20 feet, and you've got 1 inch or 1.5 inches of cable at some other impedance, you've got a couple of degrees of electrical length. You could have any impedance in the world of that splicing piece of cable. If it's an extremely small fraction of a wavelength, it has very little impact. And you can study that by doing it with a vector network analyzer, with the Smith chart, or with the Wright equation. So almost any way you solder it together, it's going to work like a charm. As long as the center conductor is making contact and the shield is not making contact and one's not short at the other. To your RFIEYE, it may look homely as all hell to you. RF-wise, it's an extremely good connection until you get up to 12.
Repeater, timeout.
It's an extremely good connection until you get up to 1296. I've done it on many an occasion. I bet you have also, Dave. N2APG, KQLIW in the TechNet.
EY with a comment.
All right, Dick, very good. Why don't you pick up the comment?
Go ahead, comment.
N1YDY again. I can only tell you how Diamond did it, and they used a small piece of circuit board that they cut the center out, and they put the centers to a hole drilled in the center, and then they put the grounds to this donut-shaped thing they did on a small piece of one-inch square PC board, and they claimed that it was the best way to attach different grades of 50-ohm coax to each other. When I say different grades, I mean they had 174 on one side that went past the trunk seal in a car, and then it went to 58 running to the radio.
Yeah, the PC board that you're describing, Hank, gives you a nice mechanical connection of different kinds of coax. But if you just did it in air as a space frame, what would you call it now, the inverted plug technique, it'll work. Everyone thinks it won't. It'll work like a charm. The crazy opinion I had when I first became a ham, when I was 16 years of age and I didn't understand coax, I assumed that all of the capacitance between the center conductor and the shield and coax was going to be shorting out my signal. I used to believe that. And therefore, I tended toward HF antennas that were in-fed, if you know what I mean, where the end of the radiator came right up to the transmitter. I believe that was the only way to do it. I had no belief in coax. I had a long way to go. So you can get away with murder on this one, Dave. Into APG, KQLIW. Were you a little bit reluctant to do it? You thought that the transmitter would explode?
Into APG. No, I think you know me better than that. I wouldn't be worried about the transmitter exploding or anything like that. But I just was kind of curious because, you know, what your opinion would be on that, what you would say. And, of course, you know, things like this is important. As hams, you know, we find ourselves in situations sometimes, and you always have to be prepared for emergencies and contingencies, things like that, and we want to get on the air no matter what if we have to, and we may encounter that situation where, you know, the coaxial cable has been broken, and we have to put it together ASAP, and we don't have anything else. So, okay, cool. Appreciate the answer, and I'll be listening at 2APG. WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I did that about 20 years ago. I said, one day I'll go get a coupling and put it in. I never did. It's also outside, but I completely covered it up with duct seal, you know, regular duct seal, which is very good stuff. And I put tape over that. Still there today. I think I got it on one of my dipoles. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the open wiring soldering leads together of two pieces of coax cable that I'm describing. Weather-wise, it's a little bit spooky. And for almost all of the frequencies we use, though, that little splice is such an extremely small fraction of a wavelength, it's going to have a very minor effect on the impedance match of those two cables. The worst-case situation is as that splice approaches a quarter wavelength. On 2 meters, where a quarter wavelength is roughly 19 inches, if you made the splice open air section 19 inches long, which of course would be crazy, then if it had, let me pick a number, 100 ohm impedance, the 50 to 100, would be a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. After a quarter wavelength, it would become, let me think now, 50 to 100 would make the other side, I think it would be 200. So you'd end up with a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, something like that. If you made it a quarter wavelength long at 2 meters, 19 inches, nobody in his right mind is going to do that. Now, by the way, if you made it a half wavelength long, 36 inches, everything, no matter what the impedance is of a piece of cable, no matter how you mismatch it at one end, if that splice is exactly a half wavelength long, it duplicates the impedance of the cable on one side to the cable on the other side. That's the magic of half wave. It repeats. But quarter wave gives you an impedance inversion. A short becomes an open becomes a short through a quarter wavelength of cable. But for a cable that's, a 30 seconds of a wavelength long, no matter what you do, it's going to work as long as it really makes contact. RF is not anywhere near as persnickety as you think it is. Let me drop. When you look at the physical layout of that very first transistor, built in 1948, it had a pair of paper clips, so to speak, with sharpened points poking into a piece of germanium to make the emitter base and collector junctions, the ugliest looking thing in the world. But it had gain, and it worked. The RF didn't know, the radio frequency didn't know how ugly that thing was physically. So there's a lot of situations where RF is blind, particularly if, for instance, you make the coaxial cable out of square center conductor and square outer conductor. There are people who lose a lot of sleep over that. As long as you got the right ratio of the inner and outer square coax cable, it'll work like a charm. Anyway, any further questions or comments, give me a call at us right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. And by the way, when it comes to coax cable, there's nothing magic about the center conductor being exactly in the center of the outer conductor. You can put the center conductor all the way over to one side. As long as you don't arc it over, it'll still work like a charm. There's a zillion different ways you could make a quasi-coax. Center conductor round, outer conductor square. Center conductor square, outer conductor round. Center conductor off-center. The center conductor can be a flat plate of material inside the outer conductor that's round. As long as you got the ratios right, it'll work like a charm. And I built a whole lot of Yagis, for instance, for 915 megacycles out of sheet metal, where the driven element, the reflector, and the director are very wide pieces of copper tape. And that made an extremely broadband, high-performance, three-element Yagi. That is a patent. If you go to my particular patent on that, and you see that thing, you'll say, gee, that doesn't look like a Yagi I've ever seen. And it's got extremely high performance. Let me drop it. It has a standing wave ratio of 1.05 to 1 across 902 to 928 megahertz inclusive. From 902 to 928, it has a 1.05 standing wave ratio with 6 dB of gain, a three-element Yagi made out of copper tape. And the copper tape is put on a piece of insulating material. And you can bend it in all kinds of ways when you see that particular patent. Next time I sign in, I'll tell you guys the patent number where you can look it up and look at the picture of this thing, and you won't believe it. And that is a manufactured product today on the front end of a radio frequency identification handheld reader. And that particular 6 dB gain high-performance antenna will allow you to read an RF tag under ideal conditions, read an RF tag at 22 feet. The RF tag is a thoroughly passive object. And 22 feet away, you can read the 92-bit code that's on that tag. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. After the beeps, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. One last call. If there's no one else with any questions or comments, we'll go over to our next section. Anybody with any questions or comments for the TechNet, Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2AMZ, I get up a slightly different topic that I've run into. HF Mobile, I've run into some problems with my car. Eric was helpful in trying to resolve it, but maybe other people have run into the problem. Let me let it drop. Did an experiment, temporarily put in a radio, grounded everything, temporary antenna, but whatever I did, more than likely RF back through the electrical system, it caused the computers, plural, in my car to go bonkers. I had to use the resetting tool, you know, the code reader tool to reset my my computers, to get the check engine lights out and get my computers, my car back to normal. Now my car is running normal. Has anyone out there, and Dick, and especially Eric, well, I know Eric has have run into that problem, having running about 100 watts on 40 meters cause your car computer to go bonkers? KD2AMZ.
Okay, we now know it's 100 watts on 40 meters. What kind of an antenna? Where was the antenna located? Did the antenna have a feed-through hole where the grounding of the antenna was the actual sheet metal of the car? Give us some words about this. And is it a problem that you've still got the mic, or did you find a solution to it? KD2AMZ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
What brand of car?
Okay, Dick, this was an experiment. I put the radio on my passenger seat, passed it through the cabling through the firewall, connected the power cabling directly to the battery. The antenna went out my window. It was a temporary outdoor antenna. It was a 31-foot monopole through a 9-to-1 UNN. The ground of the antenna system was grounded back to the chassis of the car and radio. Copy so far, and it was a 2013 Subaru Forester. And the antenna was placed in the approximate location of the where I would have placed the antenna, which was the rear passenger side at the car, within about a foot or so of that.
Now, how did you know that the computer, plural, computers, went bonkers? The first time you keyed the mic with the engine running, something happened. How did you discover what went wrong with the computers in the car? Over to you, Mike.
That's exactly what I expected noise, which I received. My received noise went from about an S3 to an S9, totally expected. But I said, let me transmit through the noise and see how I make out with the engine running. As I keyed up and had a little quick 5-minute QSO, my check engine light went on, and my cruise control light started to blink. When I shut down the engine, the check engine light went on. I probably should have read the problem code, but I said, you know what, let me just reset it and drop the experiment. Does that help, Dick?
It sure does sound like that Subaru is very vulnerable. And I guess Subaru is one of the cars that tells you if you run any other radio equipment, some special requirements exist. Was that Barry N2MB? And have you run into situations like this, Barry? N2 Moon Bounce, if that was you? K2RIW in the TechNet?
More information.
Yeah, it's Barry. years ago, Volkswagen had a big problem with that. I think they weren't shielding their computers properly. I believe that problem has long since been solved, but Subaru may have the same problem. They may not have had enough shielding on their computers.
Mike said he's got some further info. Wait for the beeps, and you got it, Mike.
Also, based on Eric's recommendation, I actually gave Subaru down in Cherry Hill, that's corporate headquarters in the United States, a phone call, got through to someone who actually knew something, and Subaru will not support any kind of radio, you know, two-way radio in their cars unless it's manufactured by Subaru. So their engineer people said, no, we will not support, we will not give you a methodology how to route the cables, how to, where to place the antenna. They just flat out say, no, don't do it. KD2AMZ, back to net control.
Sounds like somebody else has a comment. Go right ahead, give us your full ID.
KD2FIU, it's George. Can you please explain again what the antenna element was, how long it was, and where it was mounted?
Of course, George. It was a temporary antenna. I did not feel like spending $400 on, let's say, a screwdriver until my experiments were complete. I used my portable antenna, which I use for field day operations. It is a 31-foot vertical going to a 9-to-1 un-in, you know, and then from there it goes back to a tuner because the radio, in my particular case, does not have a tuner in it. And it was placed in the vicinity of the rear hatch where it would be. Then the grounds were run, and these were substantial grounds. I used jumper cables, which I ran back to the car's, not the sheet metal, but actually I ran it back, actually, believe it or not, right to the engine block, so I would be assured of having a good, good, solid ground, so the system was all commonly grounded. And again, Subaru's explanation says don't do it. They tell you flat out not to.
Mike, was the base of the antenna locally grounded to the nearest piece of sheet metal? Go ahead.
No, I got a comment here, please. KD2FIU.
You got it.
The antenna is external. It's external to the body of the mobile. And you're running conductors to bring ground. So, somehow this is not a valid mobile application. You're not utilizing the shell of the metal of the car. You're not utilizing the locality of the frame of the car. Mike, we got to start again on this experiment.
Repeater, timeout.
How the antenna's length, location, and running of grounding to the car, no matter whether it's zero resistance or not, is not really giving me a good idea in my mind as to how RF is traveling as an electromagnetic wave. And the conductivity is not really inclusive in my mind as to being a mobile application.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Let me make some comments on that.
We had a good RF grounding. Repeat, good RF grounding.
The most ideal way to feed a mobile radio would be to have a red lead and a black lead twisted together that goes through the firewall and picks up the plus and minus lead right at the battery. Your battery is a zillion microfarad capacitor, and by twisted leads for the ground and hot of the radio going all the way back to the battery, that's now a shielded lead, so to speak. You'd be amazed how good twisted pair is. The radio itself could then sit on the passenger seat of the car. The radio would look to you like it's floating. A coax cable coming out of the radio going back to the antenna, where the counterpoise of the antenna is the local sheet metal near the quarter wave ground plane at 40 meters. That, believe it or not, would be, in my opinion, a very good RF setup, which would be giving minimum RF energy to those computers on board. I suspect you have a different opinion on this one, George. KD2FIU, K2RIW, go ahead.
Hey, 2J, with a comment.
There you go, there's the man.
that order. Go ahead, George.
Dick, what you're saying is absolutely true. If all of the application is 100%, if you're going to put it in the mobile, work it from the mobile. See what you're getting. That's the experiment here. The experiment is a portable station powered by the automobile's power system and generation system to an external antenna. It's a mobile application. That's the experiment. I think let's see what the result on that is.
I thought that's the experiment he was doing. KE2EJ, K2IW, what's your recommendation, Eric? And I'm a little bit afraid that we're slowly discovering that an amateur radio operator maybe should not buy a Subaru automobile. You got it, Eric.
2, the W2VL repeater.
K2IW, K2EJ, let me hear it, recycle first. There we go. Oh, a couple things. All of the manufacturers of the various different vehicles have actually, usually have to get in touch with their headquarters to find out where to place your transmitter and how to wire it up. That's something they all do. Okay, but today, in the days of computers, and even though the computers are actually in good Faraday cages, that's not where the issue comes. All throughout the vehicle, they use something called CAN bus, which is differential, which is not so bad, but they also have something called a LIN bus, which is a single wire bus. And the data that goes through there, if you take a spectrum analyzer, just go near the car with a little bit of a whip, you'll see what I'm talking about. As I recommended to Mike, that he do a little snooping first before he decides to do a full installation in the vehicle. What you're recommending as far as power goes, that's great. But, you know, if you've got a car that's modern day, it's a freaking noise generator. And, I operate HF in a car, and I did the best I could. Actually, I got some mods from Ford to help make it quieter. But, you know, my noise floor is still like an S6 or an S7 on 40 meters, and on 20 meters, it's up and past S9, and on 80, there's a couple of clear spots, and even on 146.52, it makes a racket. Although, you gotta understand, I have a hybrid. I've got like 19 different microprocessors in this car. So, you can isolate the DC supply, but that really ain't gonna cut it. Put an antenna anywhere near the vehicle, and you've got yourself a noise generator. K2RIW, K2EJ.
That noise that you're hearing, Eric, I get the impression it's not ignition noise. You're hearing all of the clanking of all of the computers. You're hearing those clock pulses of the computers. Is that the noise that you believe you're hearing that goes up to S9? Go ahead.
No, I don't believe I'm hearing. I know I'm hearing. Actually, my car manufacturer has a spectrum plot. They show you where all the birdies are. And of course, let me put your mic down for a second. Yeah, we don't need Mr. Policeman seeing this. You will find that because of the timers and other types of things that are going on computer-wise, and don't forget, computers make square waves, and the pulse rates are different depending upon what it's controlling. I can go back a number of years when I had the Explorer, and it really didn't have much of a computer, but I had a really nasty gas pump that put out broadband noise that was unbelievable. And Ford sold a kit which you can put these caps around it and some grounding strap and minimize the noise, but you don't get rid of it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Do you suggest, Eric, that a high percentage of the current automobiles with lots of microprocessors are going to be making an awful lot of noise on, say, 40 meters, and there's almost no solution to it? You just have to live with that noise? Even with the kind of a noise blanker on the radio receiver might not help? Over to you, Eric, KGLIW.